59 or 60, there was a great flood year in Northern California, and the Eel River overflowed, washed out a number of small towns along its banks. And in the following spring, downstream and in some of the side branches of the Eel, they found countless redwood seedlings sprouting from cone seed.
What the hell have you people been smoking out there?
Which was astonishing, because very seldom ever seen redwood reproducing from seed. Usually they seem to reproduce from root runners. So experimenting with that a little bit, kept cones, little tiny redwood cones in cold water in a refrigerator for 6 months. At
what
about 40
the
degrees.
Hell have you people
then took it out
there?
And found it would germinate. And that's how they discovered how to make redwood germinate. The conclusion was that the cones reproduction side of redwood was tied to a flood of a type that comes only twice in the millennium, because that was a 500-year flood that came through that year. Cones.
Red little tiny redwood cones.
Those trees were sacred to the Omotakai in a way you can't imagine.
You know what? You throw a stick in the air around here, it's going to land on some sacred fern, for Christ's sake.
I'm not talking about some kind of pagan voodoo here. I'm talking about something real, something measurable in the biology of the forest.
Which is what exactly?
Red, little tiny redwood cones.
What we think we know is that there is some kind of electrochemical communication between the roots of the trees, like the synapses between neurons. And each tree has 10 to the 4th connections to the trees around it. And there are 10 to the 12th trees on Pandora.
Which is a lot of guessing.
It's more connections than the human brain. Get it? It's a network. It's a global network, and the Na'vi can access it. They can upload and download data, memories, at sites like the one you just destroyed.
What the hell have you people been smoking out there?
Episode 17 of the Plants Are People 2 podcast is brought to you in part by the good people doing native habitats conservation everywhere. Without them, things would look dramatically worse. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lauren Erland. I'm a research associate at UBC here in Kelowna, BC. And my research is really all about how plants are able to perceive and respond to changes in their environment and how we can use that to kind of improve our conservation focus and also apply that to things like agriculture or even just gardening in our own yards.
And so tell me a little bit about your research at Resolute Bay and what you were trying to do there and about Arctic species in general and why they're special.
Yeah, so about 3 years ago in the pre-COVID days, we had the chance to go up to Resolute Bay in Iqaluit in Nunavut, or Inuit Nunungat, the Inuit homeland in Canada. And we went up there because if you want to study climate change, those regions of the world are really experiencing climate change at the most extreme rates. So the latest estimates from the government of Canada are that they're experiencing climate change at 4 times the rate of more kind of southern locations. And so we're really interested in first, you know, what plants are up there that are able to survive in these really extreme environments, for those of us who live in the south, where, you know, you have 24-hour daylight during the growing season, your average daily temperature only goes up to about 7 degrees. And, you know, in the case of Resolute in particular, it's actually a high Arctic desert. So you're dealing with all those desert kind of conditions as well. And so they're a really, really fascinating subset of kind of global biodiversity and kind of a really poorly understood. I don't want to say poorly understood, because of course the people who live there have a very good understanding of them, but from kind of the Western science perspective, I would say understudied subset. So, you know, if you're interested in understanding how a plant responds to that change, how they will respond, going to the ones that seem to be the most at risk are kind of the way to start. So what we kind of intended to go up and do originally was to go and do botanical collections, to get botanical vouchers, seeds and tissue material to bring back for conservation projects. So we were really, really fortunate while we were up there. I went with my supervisor, Dr. Susan Murch, who's also at UBC. And we worked with an amazing guide up there. Her name's Brandy Ikluk, and she's, grew up in Resolute Bay, lives there, and really was an amazing resource for us. You know, we showed up and, you know, we don't really know what we're doing. We've never been to Nunavut before. We're like, you know, the two of us and, out on the tundra trying not to get eaten by a polar bear. While staring at the ground. And she's like, okay, but look up sometimes, right? And the biggest thing we asked her is like, what do you think is weird? What is changing? And so she took us to see some of those places where, you know, things are much greener than they used to be. And that's kind of really the theme of what you're seeing up there is greening of the Arctic overall. And that can be good. In a high Arctic desert, maybe that becomes a place where berry cultivation, which is a really important traditional country food up there, can kind of be more possible. But it can also be, you know, a bad thing if it's displacing those existing habitats. And so that's really our kind of underlying scientific goal, is to understand how that's happening, the kind of mechanisms of that. And is there a way that we can predict that, moderate that, or conserve those plants so that we kind of have a backup that we can lean back to?
What's the, you know, what's the goal if that habitat is going to go away? Worst case scenario, that habitat disappears. How do you take that plant out, you know, sort of cultivate it and then put it back into a habitat that may not be there anymore?
Yeah, so it's tricky. So, you know, the traditional approach has really been seed banking. So when we think about, you know, reserves of plants, should the worst happen, we think about like the seed bank up in Svalbard or the Millennium Seed Bank at Kew. And those are amazing, incredible resources that we have, but not all plants behave well when you have seeds. So I think anyone who's tried to grow their spring seeds and had an entire packet fail on them can probably relate. Sometimes they just don't work very well by seed. Some plants have really strict requirements for how they can grow by seed. So one of the ways that we can use in the lab to kind of get around that is this in vitro tissue culture approach. So we can basically take a seed and instead of, or we can take even growing tissue like cuttings, bring them back to the lab, and in a sterile, very controlled environment, we can, you know, give the seed absolutely everything that it could ever dream of, to be able to grow. And so one of our goals was to, you know, collect some vegetative samples to set up in tissue culture, and also some seeds, because we can also store those in kind of a living germplasm bank. So it's like a living seed bank, basically.
And so is your hope that, you know, I guess I've talked about this a few times with some other people, but you know, in my mind, I guess the genetics of those plants, you know, different things will turn on, environmental factors may turn on different genetics within that plant to say, you know, the temperature's too cold, so we're only going to grow this high, but in different conditions, that plant may grow taller. So are there plants up there that are, you know, are those pretty rare plants for that area? And so conserving those would be, I guess the question about the habitat being gone, like, are those plants so dependent on that habitat that if that's not there, they may not have those genetic variations that allow them to sort of adapt to changes in climate?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's something that is an area that needs more work. Some of them are certainly very generalist plants. So I guess to give people a picture of what it looks like when you're in Resolute, to look at the kind of just look at the plant life that's up there. It's cold, it's windy, it's dry. All of the plants, when you go up there are very, very short. It kind of looks like everything is turned into kind of a creeping vine. So there's willow trees, there's birch trees. There's lots of things like the kind of normal ditch weeds you'd expect to see, things like catchfly. We expect like a willow tree to be a tree or a large bush. But up there, it looks like ground cover. Everything grows very low to the ground and along the ground. And so it's a really interesting question, because if you take that plant and move it somewhere else, will it go back to growing like a bush? And we know that the same species of willow and birch are in other places in Nunavut. We did collections in Iqaluit actually to kind of ask the same question. Can we get the same species from both locations? And when you go to Iqaluit, the willow trees are actually so tall now that the Ministry of Environment for Nunavut is actually now having to spend money to go and kind of top the willow trees in some of the very popular hunting areas so that the hunters can see the polar bears over the willow trees, which did not used to be a problem. So for some of them, it seems like they move to a different environment and they're going to be kind of fine. They're going to be probably take off. And there's a lot of kind of Western research out there as well, saying that kind of the shrubification of the Arctic is what we expect to see. So those woody shrubs seem like they're going to do well. But the thing that we're kind of really interested in and that I'm really interested in is kind of the why and the comparative side of things. And I think we can talk about that a bit later, but for that, some of those plants that you don't see in both locations are really interesting. So things that are kind of more small herbaceous plants that we know less about that might be very important traditionally or culturally. We would like to be able to help. And so understanding that, I think, is the first step for a lot of those. So my answer, I guess, is I'm not really sure, but there's lots of things for us to do.
Was your guide up there, the woman that you talked about, was she, when she was showing you these places that really hadn't been vegetated for a while, was she experiencing things that she hadn't seen before or she wasn't familiar with? Were there plants, coming up from the permafrost or that ground that were new?
So it's actually one of the really interesting things about working in Nunavut that I've found is that there's not a lot of invasive species. It seems like that are kind of have hopped from the south, and part of that might be because it's all islands. But what she did point out is, the presence of species that are normally in some areas, but are now in other areas. So they're still kind of the species you expect to see on that island, but in the kind of the wrong spot. So a great example of this is, again, we said to her, like, what are the weird things? And we were out on, kind of middle of our week, and she came running across the permafrost to me and she's like, "You said weird stuff, right?" And I was like, "Yes, weird stuff. Please show me the weird things." And she had found this circle. It was almost a perfect circle. It was about the size of like a round dinner table. And it was actually like warm to the touch. She said, like if you sit on it, it's warm. And I was like, "What do you mean if you sit on it, it's warm? It's like the middle of the permafrost. It's like 4 degrees and kind of, cold and windy out." And so we walked over there and there's just in the middle of the permafrost, this green circle. And normally when you see patches of green on the permafrost, it's something like a lemming den, or, you've got some kind of waste deposits. So one of the places you find a lot of plants is in places where there's been human activity. So either kind of like ancient Thule sites or more modern things. So there's a Canadian Forces base in Resolute. One of the old base locations has got tons and tons of greenery, and you can imagine where that nitrogen came from. I won't go into it. But what was really interesting about this, to kind of get to the point, is that the willows and those kind of shrubby type of things weren't present in that circle. Instead, what we saw was a lot of grasses, sedges, and small herbaceous plants. And when we used our kind of infrared camera, the center of that hotspot was 10 degrees warmer than any of the other permafrost around it. And so we're really interested in this because we couldn't see any kind of obvious nutritional reason for it to be different. And so it seems like a temperature thing. So if you heat up the permafrost by 10 degrees up there, maybe on a place like Cornwallis Island, where Resolute is, what you end up getting is kind of a shrubby meadow or a scrubby meadow instead of a shrubby shrubby island. And so we've been really interested in that. One of the species we brought back from that is called Stellaria longipes. And it's a common kind of, there's a lot of different ecotypes of that one, where exactly to your point, some of them grow tall, but some of them don't. So it's very exciting, I think.
Do you think that, I saw that picture of that sort of, cutout where the it was warmer. Was that heat coming from the ground? I think it was coming up through the...
We think so. So we, unfortunately, because of the whole COVID-19 thing, there's been a lot of restrictions on travel to the territories for good reason right now. So we haven't been able to go back. But one of the things we'd really love to do if we go back is to do some more kind of testing in that area. So right now we can hypothesize maybe there's a crack in the permafrost that's leading down to kind of a geothermal vent or something like that. There have been earthquakes in the area in the last 5 years that could maybe have created something like that. But we're really not sure right now. There wasn't anything, like no obvious like decomposition or something that you might expect to release that.
And so your guide wasn't aware of that before you all went out there. It was just in the middle of, you guys were surveying and she just found it.
Yeah, it was like she said, I've never seen anything like this before. And so we're like, because the first question we asked was like, is there more? And she's like, I don't know. This is like a one-off strange thing. I've never seen it before. You wanted strange, I give you strange. Like, what else do you? Well, you guys are kind of weird, but yeah.
I'm always looking for like the weird plants out in the woods. That one thing that I haven't seen before. That search image of like, what is new?
Absolutely. It was a really incredible experience to go up there. We're really, really grateful to the communities and to our guide who let us, let us come. You can't just go to Nunavut and do a botanical survey. It's pretty strictly controlled in terms of permitting and things like that. And the local community does need to approve those permits. So I would say we're very grateful for that. Particularly given kind of their history with scientists or people who call themselves that in the past. So it was a really amazing experience. And the other thing I would say is that we've been working on is, it's called Resolute Bay, but the traditional place name for it is Kausweetuk. And so we're very grateful to that community for allowing us to come up.
Yeah, that must have been really amazing to go out into the, the surrounding area with somebody who really knew what they were looking at.
Yeah, it's an experience I certainly won't forget. And I really hope that we're able to go back in the future, but we'll just have to see.
And learning about all that cultural connections with plants and sort of, even her just telling you to look up every once in a while.
Yeah, it's a good reminder, especially for us plant nerds.
Yeah, for polar bears. Did you see any polar bears while you were up there?
We didn't, actually. We were, I think, I don't know if we're lucky or not lucky, but the area is actually one of the big polar bear hubs. But at the time of year we were there, which was late July, early August, they're still out hunting on what's remaining of the sea ice. And as it gets into late August and September, is what we were told, is when they kind of start to come and get bored, because there's no sea ice left to hunt on, especially these days. And they kind of just like hang out on the beaches and like get in fights and stuff. So I'm pretty scared of polar bears. I will have to admit. So
I think for good reason. They're sounds like they have the ability to hunt you pretty well.
Yes, I would not mess with them.
Yeah. Did you hear about, you know, maybe it was like 2012, just all this permafrost conversation reminds me of a story that came out about, I don't know where they were. Maybe it was Siberia. They were looking at these river cutouts and they could see, you know, like a ground squirrel nest from like 30,000 years ago. And the ground squirrel was pulling seeds down into their ground nest and making sort of a bed. And so they took all of that material out of that nest and they were able to germinate seeds from 30,000 years ago.
Yes, I saw this. It was so cool. I would be totally lying if I said that there wasn't like a small part of me that was like, maybe we will find some super old seeds and we can do the same thing. Unfortunately for us, we only found current seeds, but that was pretty exciting still. So I shouldn't
in a ground nest.
No, just on the plants. There are lots of little like lemming dens everywhere, but we figured we'd probably leave the poor little lemmings alone.
Yeah, I was trying to, you know, that story was so long ago. 10 years ago, that it would be cool to like have a follow-up on that and see, because you know, they were tying that to like bring the mammoth back and, you know, mixing that genetic material, you know, mammoth material with, you know, current day elephants and trying to like have that, you know,
recreate their whole ecosystem.
Yeah,
could be problematic, but
yeah.
I'm thinking Jurassic Park. It never goes well, but
I know we have to look at popular culture to figure out how to do things sometimes.
Yeah.
So from that trip and sort of that research, you were taking back, it looked like seed material, cereal, herbarium samples, and then tissue cultures.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, you're right. We brought back kind of three different types of samples. So we brought back seeds for kind of the traditional seed banking approach, and also because seeds are amazing kind of genetic reserves to be able to see variability between samples. If we take a vegetative cutting, it tells us a lot about that plant, and having tissue that grew in that environment can be really, really valuable scientifically. But of course, seeds at another level. And the third thing we brought back were herbarium vouchers. So I'm not sure if your listeners are super familiar with them, but they're basically just pressed plant samples. So you try to take a representative cutting out in the field. You know, you press it like you would, you know, if you ever did flower pressing when you were a kid in a book, you do the same thing, but just with a bigger press. And herbarium vouchers are really, really cool because, first of all, that way you know what plant you collected. So you send them to the experts. In our case, sent them to the Canadian Museum of Nature, who have a whole team that specializes in Arctic plants. And they can confirm your field identification. So we're pretty good, but, you know, some species look quite similar, and some of them we just couldn't quite figure out what they were. So they can tell you what species you're actually looking at, which has obvious value, I think, in addition to curiosity. And the other cool thing about herbariums, of course, is now you're part of a, you know, a ongoing collection that other scientists can look back in the future and say, you know, when was this plant present at this location? Was it flowering? Was it not? And so it's kind of a cool historical record to be part of, and that other scientists can access, especially for locations of plants in the Arctic, because there haven't been that many surveys up there just because of accessibility issues. So that's really interesting. And then of course the vegetative cuttings are kind of my bread and butter. So really what's inspired me to really go hard into plant research, and when I started grad school, was this idea of tissue culture. So how can you grow a plant, in a condition where it's completely removed from its environment, and where you can control kind of every aspect of what's going on. And that's what tissue culture is. It's basically you take a cutting or a seed and you put it in a sterile environment where you control kind of the media it's growing in, instead of using like potting soil or vermiculite or things like that, like we would kind of normally think about for kind of a growing medium. You have, it's either a liquid or a gel-based solid, and it's, you put in, you know, sugars, all the kind of salts and minerals the plant might need. And then if it's a solid, some kind of gelling agent. So things like agar, I think people might be familiar with. And then from there, you can of course do any number of things. You can add different plant signaling molecules that tell a plant, for example, you know, it's time to come out of dormancy. So there's a lot of chemical signals in seeds that are actually what you are affecting when you, for example, cold stratify your seeds, you put them in the freezer. One of the things you're doing is changing the levels of kind of the plant hormones that are present in that seed. And so when it comes out of the freezer, there's another shift in those levels. And that's actually part of what tells the seed, okay, it's time to start germinating now. You know, we've had winter, spring is here. And so we can artificially do that by adding those to the culture media. One of the things we were talking about before was, you know, can you actually do this, in your backyard? If you have, you know, that packet of seeds you really want to grow, but they're just a pain.
And can I ask a couple questions about this before
yeah.
we go to that?
Yeah, absolutely.
The agar, is that, how are you purchasing that? Are you purchasing that as like a mix that you're making, or are you purchasing it on the sort of in the dishes already pre-made?
It actually comes as a powder. Okay. It's fairly inexpensive. I think you can actually get it at cooking stores because people, they call it agar. I'm not sure why the two agars. But people use it for like making like jellies and molds and stuff. If you ever watch like those cake competition shows, they're like, and now I will use this very innovative compound called agar. And I'm like, ooh, plants.
Is that like, is it pretty benign? I mean, what's in it?
Yeah. So it's derived from seaweed. Okay. And so it's a seaweed extract. So I guess you could consider it to be like a natural product. There are some kind of agar substitutes that we use in the lab as well. One called phytogel that would be a lot harder to get outside of a lab environment, and it's more expensive. One of the cool things about agar is because it's extracted from algae, so a living organism, is you can actually have some of those plant hormones that are present in the agar. And that's can be really helpful for some growing sun plants. But if we're trying to do experiments to understand those plant signals, which is a lot of what I do in the lab, it can be kind of it can interfere, right? If there's unanticipated other things you're adding in.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, if you think about like Jell-O, it's like the Jell-O powder, but it doesn't have raspberry flavoring in it.
Yeah, clear Jell-O.
Yeah.
Is the liquid one, you know, versus the more gelatin one preferred for something like a stem cutting versus seed?
Yeah, so it tends to depend. So one of the problems I don't know. I'm sure if you've ever like water propagated a cutting at home, you know, some cuttings just do really well and some cuttings kind of just rot at the bottom when you put it in water.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of the same thing that we run into. You don't always know. There's no rule for like these plants will do better, these plants will do worse. It would be nice if that was the case. But for things like seeds, the solid or the semi-solid gel media tends to be more useful because the seeds just seem to like it. I think it's because seeds like to grow into something. So they, you know, have something to grow their roots in and they anchor themselves. And, you know, I think it's like a plant.
Yeah. Now would there still be a stratification period that you would do before you would put them into that agar, or does the agar and sort of the nutrients and maybe hormones that you're putting into that agar affecting that? And so you can just sort of skip that like 60-day stratification period?
In some cases, but in some cases there's just like no substitute for a little time in the fridge. And that's because it's a complicated process. I oversimplified a bit by saying, you know, the hormones go up, the hormones go down. But you know, it's not necessarily one hormone. You know, if we think about us, we've got this like vast network of signals going on. And plants are even more complicated than that. So some plants you can get around it. Things like abscisic acid and gibberellic acid. You know, if anyone has done kind of orchard work, you've probably run into those. Can be useful in that, but sometimes you know, plants don't always want to do what we want them to do.
Right. And how are you controlling sort of? You know, I was looking at, there's certain hormones that'll cause plant cells to differentiate into roots versus stems or leaves or, and so are you actually controlling that in those petri dishes with some sort of addition?
Yeah. So for our basic seed collections, we try to start as minimally as possible. So we usually start with no hormones in the media. And try to just, you know, give the plants, kind of baby them, give them the things that will make the seed feel like this is a good place to grow. And then we start to kind of get tougher with them as we go. So, there's this kind of, implant tissue culture. There's this, key fundamental concept, which is that there's these two main classes of hormones. One is auxin. So if you've ever used rooting powder, that's auxin. And the other is cytokinins, which maybe people are less familiar with. Things like benzylaminopurine is one of these. And when you put auxin in, not surprising because it's rooting powder, you get roots. And when you have high levels of cytokinins, you get shoot growth. And so in that way, especially if we want to do experiments to understand how plants grow, or we want to grow up you know, take a seed and grow it into 1,000 different little cuttings. So we could make a single seed, make thousands of shoots if we wanted to, that you can cut each of those and make, you know, a new baby plant from. Then we start to get into that hormone thing. And you can see how if you're working with conservation and something you can't get very much seed from, or seeds very ineffective to germinate from, those types of approaches can start to become really interesting.
So is that the tissue culture? Is it, you just need a really small amount of that? You just really need like the DNA?
You need a whole plant. So you can't do okay. the Jurassic Park DNA thing. Which still scares me. I'm gonna have nightmares tonight. But you need a whole piece of tissue. So it can be a single cutting from a leaf. It can be a single intact plant cell. It can be a seed, but it needs to be at the minimum an intact plant cell to be able to grow, because it's really We're not creating anything. We're just kind of telling, encouraging the plant to kind of keep growing.
We've used, or we, but the industrial farming complex has been using auxins for different things for a long time, for like ripening unripe vegetables and things to send them across the country, right? Or to keep them reduced in ripeness until they get there.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the like ethylene is another plant hormone that you maybe don't think about, but that's, you know, the putting your bananas with your unripe fruit to get them to ripen is you're doing exactly the same thing. It's just, you know, we're trying to do it with kind of vegetative tissue.
And so that, you know, I guess this is a methods question for your experiments with this, but are those, you know, the cocktail that you're sort of, you said that you sort of keep it pretty blank in the beginning to see sort of where you need to go probably, or think about where you need to go. But are those additional things that you're adding in to, you know, promote root growth or shoots, or are those things that you can buy commercially to put into that?
Yeah. So the hormones are a bit trickier. I think you, like the rooting powder, obviously you can go to your garden center and get that. Some of the other ones I think can be a bit trickier to get a hold of in terms of the hormones, but the basic composition of that media, we have really good success growing a lot of things on just a very simple sugar mixture. So an example of this is, you know, when we were in the Arctic, we decided when we were up there, we were going to take vegetative cuttings. Originally, we were planning to just take seeds and vouchers. And we got up there and we're like, it'd be really good to have some tissue that has experienced this environment, because, you know, I don't want to say like tissue memory. It starts to sound a bit like, I don't know, we're being crazy people, but you know, the plant has experienced that and it's developed responses to that. And there's kind of unique information in that. And so I brought up some electrolyte tablets with me because I knew we were going to be out in the field for long days and, you know, just safety first. And so I looked at the bottle of electrolyte tablets and it has, you know, basic salts, minerals, and sugar in it. And that's basically all we put in our culture media. So what we ended up doing was we took, I don't want to do like free advertising for the company, but we did have these noon electrolyte tablets that have dextrose as the sugar source, and all these basic electrolytes. And we put the plants in that with a little bit of Head and Shoulders. If you're ever trying to collect plants from outside and you're getting a lot of fungal contamination, Head and Shoulders has a fungicide in it.
That crazy Head and Shoulders really works.
Sure does.
That's how it helps with your dandruff. So if you put like a little pump of Head and Shoulders and shake it up in your liquid, that'll really keep that contamination down. We threw the plants in that and brought them back to the lab and they loved it. They were just growing. I had them in just like plastic tubes with the diluted noon and Head and Shoulders. And I got them back in the lab. I was like, okay, we're going to get them into proper tissue culture. Now let's like optimize the perfect media recipe for them, start throwing all these labby things at them. And most of them died because they just did not want my optimized special media recipe. They were plants. And this is, you know, again, think like a plant. They're plants growing in nutrient poor conditions where they're used to having to like scrap it out to survive. So if you baby them too much, they're like, whoa, what's going on?
Yeah.
And so, yeah, sometimes the simplest solution that you can just pick up at your grocery store is the most effective.
And how long will, you know, something in a test tube live like that? How long, what's the lifespan of that?
If you keep replenishing the media and you kind of, we call it subculturing. So if they fill their container, you take cuttings from that and start new containers, you can maintain them indefinitely. So this is the idea of these kind of living germplasm banks, is instead of having seeds, you have living tissues that you can, you know, grow up quickly into, you know, from one box of, you know, five plants into 5,000. If you ever needed to do like a replanting project or agriculture it's really commonly used for.
And is sterility important when you're putting that together?
Yeah. In
the field, it's probably a little hard.
Yeah, it's a great question. excellent point. So yeah, in the field, we use the Head and Shoulders for our kind of contaminant control. But when you get into the lab, if you're going to maintain things for that long, obviously bacteria and fungal spores grow much faster than plants do. So sterility is a big thing. So if we start seeds, for example, on an agar-based medium, what our kind of usual protocol is to use 20% bleach with a little bit of Head and Shoulders. We usually do kind of a 10 to 15 minute kind of rinse in that, you know, shake it around, just make sure you've got lots of contact, and then dump it out and use like boiled, or in our case, we use autoclave, but it's basically just boiling the water. So it's sterile water, and give it a few rinses to get rid of that bleach so it doesn't continue to, you know, damage the tissue itself. Hopefully just get rid of those contaminants on the surface, and we can go from there. And that's usually pretty good.
Thank you for sort of going through that. I feel like I have a pretty good understanding of how to take that and sort of run with it.
That's amazing. That makes me so happy. The only other kind of tip I'll say on that front is when you're manipulating the tissues, use like metal tweezers. And to really keep contamination down, I've also done this. You look like a bit of a crazy person, but if you have any high proof, low sugar alcohol in your house, like whiskey.
Like Cheetos?
Yeah. Something vodka. That you don't really want to drink because it's just like... Yeah, even better. Just put a bit of that in a shot glass and dip your, do this with caution so that you do not light yourself on fire. But dip the tweezers in the alcohol and then run them through a candle flame, and that will sterilize your tools that you're using as well. And that really helps.
And that's in, are you using like Erlenheimer flasks?
We usually just use petri dishes, or actually the kind of original culture things we use are glass baby food jars. Work really, really well.
Huh. And you're just making sure that's sterile before you put that stuff in it.
Yeah, just run it through like canning jars would also work. Just run it through your dishwasher on like the pots and pans cycle. And then as you go to use them, just kind of like open up your dishwasher and pull them out as you go. Or you can do the same way if you've ever done canning, where you like boil your jars on the stove. You can do that too. I'm just lazy and I have a dishwasher. So I just pull them out of the dishwasher one at a time. I like open the dishwasher, pull a jar out, close the dishwasher, fill it, and go from there.
And so there's, as your little seedlings start to germinate, there's no like, really, they have all the nutrients they need. They probably don't need water.
No water.
Oxygen. Are you like opening that jar every once in a while to sort of circulate air through there, or no?
So usually like I don't put the, you don't use like a tightly sealed jar. Okay. So don't like use like the full snap cap canning lids. If you're using a baby food jar, like twist it on most of the way, but don't like tighten it down. And that usually provides enough oxygen exchange that they're fine. If you have, like, if you want to get really fancy with it, we sometimes use that like Metapore tape that they use for like bandaging wounds. Like is breathable. You can use that to seal it. But even in the lab, I get lazy and don't use it sometimes. So.
And is that sufficient to keep that container sterile?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Yeah. The only other technology we have in the lab is a sterile flow bench. Or a laminar flow hood that blows filtered air over your workspace. But to be honest, if you're careful with things, I've done it on my kitchen table. I sent a friend some mint cuttings across the country in just that I did on my kitchen table, and they were fine. So
I remember reading about this a long time ago with, I was interested in orchid propagation, and I always thought that I was going to need an autoclave to do it because there was such a sterility component that I wasn't going to be able to meet that. And so I never really pursued, I looked up directions on like how to build my own autoclave, how to like, you know, going down this sort of the wrong rabbit hole. But I'm glad that, you know, to hear that you're successful doing that, because now that's sort of like made me believe that it's possible that I can do it without, you know, that high tech sort of, you know, infrastructure that a university would have, but I'm not going to have here in my house.
Yeah. I mean, if you have a dishwasher, you basically have a mini autoclave already. You know, that's all it is. You know, steam and temperature, it's just, you get the pressure with the autoclave. If you have like a pressure canner, that is also like in some labs, that don't do a lot of stuff. They actually just have these autoclaves that look like pressure canners. It's basically that. So you can do the same thing, in a pressure canner, and it functions exactly the same way. You've got heat, you've got pressure, and you've got steam. It is the same as an autoclave. I've actually seen some of the new pressure canners at like Canadian Tire here, labeled like canners autoclave.
Yeah, it's a project that I'll probably spend the rest of the winter, you know, just as something else to do, another thing to add to my plate to figure out. That's really exciting. I can't wait to, I'll probably order some of that stuff and try it.
I would be super curious to hear how that goes.
Yeah. And so that, is that how you got to this? You know, we started talking because of the Castellagia species, and were you doing that just as a test, an experiment on a side experiment?
Yeah. So for the paintbrush that like I mentioned before, we couldn't go back up to Nunavut because of the COVID restrictions. And so we live in another desert environment where UBC is in Kelowna. It's one of Canada's only desert. And so I thought, you know, we have a really cool contrast here that we can make. We have plants from a high Arctic desert in the lab. What if we have kind of a more temperate, moderate desert that we live in, and we can have some plants to compare. And so we did some just little collections on the side for some interesting plants, and started growing some of them up. So in some cases, we tried to find plants that we had gotten the same, at least genus of, in the Arctic. So maybe not the exact same species, but closely related. So we can do some kind of comparative research. But one of the things I just think is really cool are these hemiparasitic plants. I just think it's fascinating. And I think part of it is because I study plant signaling, you know, the idea of how does it find a host plant? How does it communicate? I just think it's really, really cool. And so I went out and collected some, I think it's Castilleja minuata. And you know, when I was looking kind of on like the garden center site, sometimes I just tried to buy our seeds from garden centers. There's a lot of comments about like, they're kind of picky to try and grow in soil, you know, poor germination. And my PhD lab actually did a conservation project on golden paintbrush, which is a at-risk species of paintbrush in Canada. So I stole their protocol. I said, well, if it's too hard to grow in soil, we'll just start with the one they used for like the hardest to grow paintbrush. And what it ended up being was just that really basic sugar, salt, agar recipe, in the light, like 16-hour photo period, and grew them up that way. And then we're going to start doing some hopefully fun experiments on them to understand their kind of communication.
How long did it take them to germinate?
The first ones were starting to germinate within about a month. And I've got full sized in tissue culture, full tubes of plants now, and it's probably been about 3 months. So I've got, you know, if you wanted to plant them out, they would be big enough to do that at this point, fully rooted, good vegetative growth, sending up nice tall shoots.
And so it's thought, I don't know if this is confirmed or not, but it's thought that those need sort of that host plant to be a long-term member of that ecological community. So is that, you think you're going to have to find sort of host plants to plant those next to, probably some carex species or something like that?
So we can cheat by keeping them in tissue culture. They actually don't need a host plant. So one of the big things they get from host plants for a lot of parasitic and hemiparasitic plants is carbon, right? And carbon is just sugar. So we can give them the sugar in media, and we can keep them going, hopefully, as long as we need them without a host plant. But it does feel kind of mean to the plant.
Well, it's for the betterment of the rest of the plants, right?
Yeah. So one of the things we kind of anecdotally saw when they were working on the golden paintbrush was the kind of nodules that those plants form with their roots to infect their host plants. They sometimes get confused and start to just make those in the tissue culture media with that sugar present. So it does seem like it is adequate, at least in the plants' minds.
Yeah, there's a whole, you know, that family of plants has a bunch of different, at least where I live, there's, you know, Castilleja is a rare plant, Canophyllus, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that, that's another rare plant up here. And so those are probably ones that people are actively trying to learn about the cultivation of. So this seems like a definite thing that conservation seed banks, people trying to put things back or take seeds out and sort of learn about them, is definitely something we should all be trying.
Yeah. And I will say, like, with the tissue culture approaches, we get pretty good seed germination compared to a lot of kind of the more traditional germination approaches. It works well for things that have poor seed germination. But kind of a word of caution, since we're talking about conservation, is there's, just because you can doesn't mean you should. So we can start with a single seed and we could propagate out 1,000 or 1,000,000 plants from that single seed. And that's fine if we want to do research on them. But, you know, everything you propagate is more or less a clone. They're more or less genetically identical. There is some variation that's introduced. It's called somaclonal variation through the tissue culture process, but you don't want to plant out 1,000 identical plants into an ecosystem because you're going to wreak havoc on the genetics. So usually when we talk about tissue culture for conservation, we're talking about, you know, being able to germinate more of those seeds so that you have better germination, or, you know, you get a representative sample of all of the genetic diversity in that population and then grow an equal amount of all of them out to plant out.
I'm thinking primarily about that process for seeds, just because there are, in New England, we have a seed bank that's for native plants. And I agree with you. I think that putting clones out into sensitive habitats isn't a good practice, but trying to, you know, having a shortcut to sort of germinate some of those seeds and increase, you know, the genetic diversity of those populations, especially for seeds that are difficult, unknown, or finicky to germinate, that could be a real, like, you know, backdoor to figuring that stuff out.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. I want to just make clear to people that I do not advocate for destroying ecosystems with clones.
Yeah. No. I think everyone will understand. Do you want to talk about the melatonin and serotonin thing?
Yeah. So this is my, I don't want to call it my pet project, kind of the thing that is my, what everything tends to circle back to. Every time I start something, I always find a way to funnel it into this. And so we've been talking a lot about plant hormones and hormones that we're used to thinking about in plants, but you know, hormones are universally present in plants, in your pet, in you. And so one of these things that we maybe don't intuitively think about being in plants are neurotransmitters. So melatonin and serotonin, obviously we think about them, you know, serotonin is the happy molecule, melatonin is the sleepy molecule, and that's what they do in people. Plants don't have an analogous kind of neurological system, so we don't expect to see them, but plants actually have all of the same neurotransmitters that we produce. You know, when you first tell people this, they're like, oh, you're a crazy person. Like, plants don't have brains. Why are you trying to study neurotransmitters in plants? But a good signal is a good signal. You know, the structure of how a compound, you know, is able to achieve that signaling function doesn't really have anything to do with having a brain. And so I've been really interested in these compounds because they're kind of unusual. And we don't really have as good of an understanding of what they're doing in plants. And because I'm interested in how plants respond to stress, it turns out these compounds are, these like neurotransmitters are really important in how a plant senses its environment and is able to survive in those environments. So an example would be, we did a recent study where we actually put these fluorescent glowy tags onto melatonin, because one of the things we don't even know is where does it go in a plant. So we know, you know, auxin, you know, has this gradient through a plant. It's made you know, at the apical meristem, and it travels down, and we know all of these things about it, but we don't know this for things like melatonin. So we labeled the invisible molecules with a glowing ball, essentially.
Radioactive?
No, actually, it's just a UV and fluorescent active tag. So actually, I was having some fun in the lab. If you take just a cheap black light and you shine it on these labels, they glow green. It looks like highlighter. Huh. So you can do it pretty low tech as well.
Huh.
So we looked at like where are these in the plant, and if we heat or cold shock the plant, what happens? And what you see is that these molecules move. They go from being kind of growth related places to exploding out into the plant to all the places where the plant might have stress. And it acts to kind of directly counteract things like free radical production to prevent the photosynthetic apparatus, to prevent DNA damage and things like that.
Now, is that more of like an original use for what those molecules were intended for in like prehistoric or like eukaryotic use?
Yeah. Exactly. So the hypothesis is, and we're getting into the realm of like hypotheses and ideas and guesses now. But the hypothesis is that the presence of things like melatonin, that's a really, really good antioxidant. So we think about vitamin C as a good antioxidant. It's kind of like what's marketed to us, but melatonin actually can do 5 times better in terms of antioxidant power than vitamin C. It's just like a comparison. And so there's a hypothesis that those original organisms, like little protists or archaea, that were present billions of years ago on the Earth, as the Earth's atmosphere became oxygenated, the ones that had melatonin and serotonin. Serotonin is kind of the precursor to melatonin when you look at their biosynthetic pathway. So when you talk about one, you're usually talking about both. But presence of those molecules is part of what let them survive and confer this huge kind of adaptive advantage. So it's another reason why kind of we expect to see them everywhere, because they were in those first life forms.
Yeah, it's amazing that it's hard to wrap your head around that we were all sort of, you know, we all come from the same thing.
Yeah, we were all pond scum.
Yeah. and all of these, like, you know, all of these little things that people are researching that are included in all of us is clear evidence for that.
Yeah, we all need to give plants a little bit more credit. I think they've got all of the amazing chemistry we have, and then a whole lot more. So
we use them for different purposes than plants do. And then we started getting into hypotheses about what maybe some of that stuff means. So what is your hypothesis as to why plants, or how plants use these? And then what does that mean for future research, or what are the next questions?
Yeah. So it's really interesting that, you know, we think that they had this huge adaptive advantage billions of years ago. As we're looking at, you know, facing more extreme changes in our climate and our ecosystems, my hypothesis is that these compounds are going to be important again. And the plants that have, you know, high levels or presence of these compounds at the right time of their life or in the right place in their tissues are going to do better. Because, you know, I'm not into reinventing the wheel. If they were able to kind of allow these original organisms to survive under huge changes, I think that they're going to be important moving forward. So one of the things that I've been really interested in all of these collections we've been talking about in all of these experiments is, you know, what is the role for those compounds? Can we, you know, use them to screen for plants that, you know, maybe we don't know which plants are going to do well, which plants are going to need help. And we've got, you know, 200 or 300 plants in a particular habitat, and we have limited resources. How do we start to prioritize those resources? Or from, you know, the agricultural perspective, you know, how can we select for varieties that will perform better so that we can keep feeding people, and all of those types of questions. So those are my like kind of big scale questions that I'm really interested in asking. And a lot of those experiments come down to, we have a plant that grew in Resolute, in Iqaluit, and in the Okanagan Valley, in the South, kind of where I live. And are there patterns, are there comparisons we can make that we can learn things from them? And that's kind of, it seems all very disparate, like, oh, plants over here, plants over there. We're looking at this, we're looking at that. We've got 10 different tissue types, but it all's really pulled into this idea of understanding how plants are going to perform. Can we challenge them in tissue culture in the greenhouse to see, okay, this one we thought was going to do really well, but actually they've all died. That's a red flag. Maybe we need to, you know, prioritize some of the conservation efforts towards those species.
Do you want to shout out your Instagram?
Sure. Yeah. I'm on all the social things as @plantdrlauren. Yeah, this was a lot of fun for me. And if you or anyone else has questions about stuff, they're welcome to reach out anytime. I'm pretty good at checking things, so.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for coming on and taking the time to do that. I know there are, you know, looking at the listeners, I know there's a bunch of people on the West Coast in British Columbia that tune in. So I'm sure they'll be excited to have, you know, a local on, hear about some plants from their area. So I appreciate that.
Thanks. It was fun.
Yeah. We'll see you.
Keep in touch.
Bye.